One of my crusades is to let the world know you don't have to be a dummy to be a Christian. And I'm really looking for language to describe the right kind of pastor. Well, pastors are all right, and preachers. And they're going out the gate, they won't be so hung up on the name Reverend. That's for starters. Let's get comfortable. I'm really not down on all preachers and all churches. I grew up in one. My dad was the pastor, and that was all right. My dad was a good man. I built on a foundation that was laid by someone else. It's that tradition-bound, ostrich head in the sand, looking backwards, entrenched, legalist that I'm against. Now, you get the idea also that Christianity can only be represented by the television evangelists on Sunday. I do not think they represent Christianity at large. They've just gotten so powerful that people are scared to disassociate from them. I want to disassociate from them. I don't want anybody to even put me in the same crowd with television evangelists. Any of them. Haven't seen one yet I would want to be seen eating in a restaurant with. Take it back. One, I'd like him to sign the check for more than $150. But there are brilliant, scholarly, faithful, committed, courageous men of God everywhere. They're the ones that ought to be applauding and standing up and shouting for joy that an alternate voice has come along that's willing to say, that's wrong. Do you know that Protestantism began with a courageous man nailing 95 theses to a door of a church and saying, the whole church is wrong? For centuries it had dominated people's minds. We can't conceive that. This one guy. Now, he'd been the route. He'd done everything. He'd followed their traditions, tried to get a deliverance from a guilt trip of sin, crawling the steps of the Lateran Palace in Rome on bleeding knees. Oh, you can get relief from sin by crawling these steps, because these are the steps that Jesus was dragged up and stumbled up, taken from Jerusalem and reassembled and put in the Lateran Palace in Rome. He's crawling these steps on his knees till they're bleeding. And he leaps to his feet, and the Word of God was quickened. The just by faith shall live. It's an Old Testament passage. It's quoted three different times in the New Testament. Each of the times, you can take the phrase and italicize a different word, and you'll understand the use of it. The book of Romans uses it. The just by faith shall live. And each other passage either emphasizes the just or emphasizes the faith or emphasizes shall live. God must have thought it was important to put it three times in the New Testament, quoting the original and fourth quote out of the Old. Those whose righteousness, which is the meaning of just, is by faith, they'll live. He took on the whole church world. I mean, you know, that was a declaration of war to nail his 95 theses to that beaten world door. Do you know how many Protestant churches today cannot conceive of a preacher being that aggressive, that belligerent? that intolerant, that offensive, that much of a troublemaker? Do I dare say this? Crap disturber? Now, I wouldn't dare say that other thing. It's literal. But what the church has been laying on us is a bunch of crap. Really. And he disturbed it all. I mean, do you realize how many people's faith was going to be shaken? Do you realize how many might even lose their faith in the church? They're just looking for somebody to say something like that so they can say, "I told you so." You know how long those traditions had endured? Thousands of people. Had wept and cried and crawled their way in penance to peace with God because some preacher told them, "Crawl on, saints, and peace will come." You know how many indulgences had been sold and how much peace had come from people doing all these painful things to get their relatives out of purgatory? And this troublemaker, in front of everybody, I mean, he nailed it right there. He didn't even nail it on the inside of the door. He nailed it on the outside of the door. That's why they were called Protestants, Protestants. All they've become is tunts. Without the protest. We need some new protesters and fewer tunts. Well said. Yeah. When you hear crap like the Roman Empire fell over sports, I suppose that means the Russians are more Christian than we are because they ain't coming to the Olympics. You suppose they listen to that TV evangelist that empires fall over sports and they're staying home? Maybe ought to move to Russia because they're really going along with that evangelist message. Of course, I'm funning satirically. Roman Empire fell over games, food, entertainment, homosexuality, and divorce. Now, going out the gate, don't try to be a historian if you ain't one. Because Rome ain't that simple. These people that, you know, that is presented as eloquent scholarship for Christianity. Oh, he even knows how to say Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And yet nobody ever takes somebody like Joseph C. Dillo, the waters above, Earth's pre-flood vapor canopy, and introduces it to Christianity. No, you get somebody out there frothing at the mouth against evolution, which they don't understand. And the dinosaurs were experimental dream images that God put in the soil while he was building this 7,000-year-old earth. and that God just created this whole universe with a capsule of light already 500 million years from its source. Just hung it out there in the vast darkness so that when we learn how to measure out of Einstein's theories that the fastest thing is the speed of light, this light ray that's reaching this point from that star source that takes 500 million years to get there, God just created it 500 million years on its journey already, so it would make us ask questions. Yeah, I'm tired of these kind of people. Dillo is University of Oregon, bachelor, Dallas Theological Seminary, and they're at their best when they get into this. When they get into theology, they need me to rattle their cage. But he's a scientist and theologian in Vienna, Austria. He has taken Isaac Bale's theory, though others have thought of it, the canopy theory, which postulates a primeval body of water surrounding the earth above its atmosphere, identified with the waters which were above the firmament. We've talked about this. You know, the Dogon people got their knowledge of Sirius B, the star white dwarf that can't be seen with the natural eye, but which they worship and build their whole calendar and religious ritual around, which they say is the center of the universe and the source and place of heaven. They claim a being they call Nomo came from the land of the fishes, as they say, and taught them this knowledge. And I've sat around and postulated imaginatively what it was like before the flood. Because the King James speaks of a firmament. Literally, its expanse. God separated, if you go to the literal, separated water. And separated water into water above and water below. And man lived on the crust of land adjacent to the water below and looked up through the firmament, which was an expanse, to the water above. And I've kidded and said, you suppose there were fish there? And you get up in the morning and see if your favorite fish is swimming right up there. Lovers would lay out in the meadow and watch fish instead of looking at the moon. Just when he was about to lay one on her, God in his infinite wisdom would have a shark swim by. Go on. And when the girl was uttering that sweet talk and saying, will you marry me? God would have a big, mighty tentacle, giant squid just hover over. I mean, if I were God, I'm telling you, I would entertain myself. Any guy in a moment of weakness and meekness, laying there in the embrace of that sweet young thing, looking up, and she says, marry me. And he sees that squid with its tentacles begin to close. Telling you, I'd dig a rut in that meadow running. I talk about an object lesson. And this innocent little girl when he is... Man, that would have been an entertaining heaven. Ethel's having flashbacks. I didn't tell you. When anybody is at 80 years of age, approaching it, all women approach it. And take so much joy in a subject like this, you've got to give them credit. Or do we give Stan credit? But when this sweet young thing is laying there and he's whispering in her ear, that baloney that men have always whispered, and she looks up there and sees a shark open his mouth. Divine, providential nudgings, that would be. It would be an interesting heaven to look through the fish. Don't you think? Now, I don't know whether that's the way it was or not. But I know this, that the earth was different before the flood. It never rained, if you believe the Bible. There never was a rainbow, if you believe the Bible. And how many of you know that the Hebrew has a word for sun and moon? But the King James is wrong if there's any implication suggested that when God talked about day and night and the lights that are seen, if you think the word in the original is the Hebrew word for sun and moon, you're wrong. There was a light by day and a light by night, and it took modern translations to assume that the word used was sun and moon. But there was a word for sun and there was a word for moon, and it's not used. Now, there's one you didn't know, huh? Well, I'll show you when I teach verse by verse through Genesis, which I'm going to do. It was assumed. But if it was the sun and the moon that was seen, why weren't the words used? They had the words. Years ago, a guy named Isaac Vail, kind of interesting because his brother founded the local newspaper over here, the Pasadena Star, which is now the Independent Star News. Small world, isn't it? Isaac Vail was born in 1840 near Barnesville, Ohio. He was one of a family of seven brothers and two sisters who resided on a farm that, interestingly, had its own coal pit. The family were Quakers who attended the local meeting of the Society of Friends. Today, we would probably think of them as activists. They participated in providing on their farm an underground railway or railroad station to aid escaping runaway slaves. Their pains were rewarded or punished by vindictive sympathizers of the slave people who hamstrung the Vail family cattle so many times that the parents ultimately moved west to Iowa. It's hot in here. Turn the cooler to the bottom and make it as cold as you can make it. Go help them, Peter. Isaac N. for Newton, Vail. Yeah, do that, Joe. Turn some lights out. Attended school in Westtown, Pennsylvania. Then he taught for a time. at Westtown Boarding School. Shortly returned to Barnesville and started a school for young scholars. His wife died shortly thereafter. He remarried. He began lecturing in various towns in Ohio and then Iowa. In 1874, he published his first little tract entitled The Waters Above the Firmament. In 1885, his book, The Story of the Rocks, expanded his ideas. Then, republished in 1902 as, quote, The Waters Above the Firmament or The Earth's Annular System. During the latter part of his life, from about 1887 to 1912, Bale lived in Pasadena, California, where, incidentally, one of his brothers founded the local newspaper, the Pasadena Star. Pasadena is an interesting town. He expanded on the theory that the pre-flood Earth had a canopy of rotating See if I can find some pictures. Come on in close, take a picture of this one. On March 4th, 1979, this remarkable photograph was taken of the planet Jupiter by the Voyager 1 spacecraft. The first evidence that Jupiter may have a ring about it was based on this photo. A line has been drawn around Jupiter to show the position of the extremely thin, faint ring. The ring thickness is estimated to be 19 miles or less. Jupiter is surrounded by a kind of canopy of ammonia clouds floating in a dense methane atmosphere. Let's look at some more. Got to get the whole page, Mike. This mosaic photograph of Jupiter was assembled from six violet images taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft on February 27, 1979, at a distance of 4 million miles from the planet. The great red spot is located below the center of the photo. Note the turbulence associated with the equatorial jet, clocked at 260 miles an hour, and the more northerly atmospheric current. Here's the equatorial jet, and here's the more northerly atmospheric current. These atmospheric currents represent, among other things, attempts by the atmospheric system to balance the heat budget between the equator and the poles, that is, to keep the temperature constant in this rotating canopy. Such upper atmospheric jet streams undoubtedly characterize the Earth's ancient vapor canopy and serve the same function as the jet streams on Jupiter. Now, as I talk on this, I do not want to imply that I am, at this point, listen closely, that I am at this point saying that the pre-flood Earth had a vaporized canopy. I am prepared to recognize the possibility that God created some kind of rotating plastic bubble full of water. Plastic wouldn't be the word. I just picked that as an analogy. With some substance held together that had real water in it, like a rotating aquarium. From that extreme to vapors. I can speculate about the sharks and the giant squid. At this point, we're open. The point I'm making is that there are thinking people that have spent their life researching and relating science and scripture and providing the research for the kinds of things that I keep teaching on TV, and yet they've never received any prominence as voices for Christianity. They get swept under the rug. I don't know why most of the academicians in religion departments and universities and schools are not applauding and calling in every day. Though we may have many disagreements, which would be part and parcel of a university faculty, at least the bell is finally being rung on TV that the Sunday dopes do not necessarily represent Christianity. You say, how cruel. Well, then they ought to quit acting so dopey. I mean, when you got problems like this to deal with, don't waste all afternoon having God melt fat off somebody. Just tell them to go on a diet and exercise. Or go see a doctor if they got a glandular problem. I mean, if it's a glandular problem, God should treat the glands, not melt the fat, because it'll come right back. It makes God look like a dope. Can't you see all heaven leaning over the battlements? Hey, look, they're throwing pills and cigarettes on the stage of this auditorium for Jesus' sake. Jesus died for the sins of the world. Best he can get is a carnival. You ever seen those carnival things where you throw for little old stuffed animals? Look, the Christians can hit the stage. The dopes on Sunday do not necessarily represent Christianity at large. Now, if you want to defend the dopes, have at it. I did for too many years. Until one day I decided, what am I doing? It's like Luther, the wasted years defending the junk that he had to finally disturb in the Catholic Church. The reason I'm going strong, I cry over the wasted years of defending the dopes. They always called me when they needed defense. Nobody ever is pointing out the hard. You know why? They couldn't read. They couldn't. You think they're going to read this? And then come to some of the hard part. As they start proving the canopy theory from the Planck function. In order to solve 7.2 and 7.3, the Planck function must be evaluated for the sun, for the Earth's surface and for each layer of the atmosphere. We use the Planck formulation given by Paltridge and Platt, V equals P1 V3 over XP. Solar flux at the top of the atmosphere. We employ the following formulation. Take a look at it. Then it gets down to these formulas. You know, Christianity is not supposed to think and work out curves and canopy temperature profiles and prove up their case by using their brains. Computer output of equatorial canopy profile. I mean, that's pretty heavy stuff. Movements of parcels of air into a temperature inversion. Taylor vortices between two concentric rotating cylinders to start to show the effect of the canopy rotating. I'm not asking anybody to get into this to the degree that this author does. I'm just saying, you don't have to be a dope to be a Christian. The dynamics of the canopy. Visibility through the vapor canopy. Relative intensity of visible stars. Luminances and visual magnitude of standard light sources. Raleigh scattering and Beer's law. The very fact this guy spells his name like a can of beer would turn most Christians off, wouldn't read any further. I mean, you know, no good thing could come from that. Look at this. Let us change the variable of integration from distance X through the vapor to distance O, in Greek, through the equivalent depth of liquid water. That's the long E pronounced O in Greek. The conversion for factor would be dx, density of the liquid, dO, density of the vapor, equal Look at that. Figure that formula out. I turn Lee loose with our computer. Look at this formula down here. Therefore, we may write as optical path. Looks like advanced math. Am I boring you? The effect of a greater zenith angle on the optical path of a light ray, diagrammed out, angles above the horizon, which stars of various magnitudes would come into view under the canopy. Now that raises a question. He discusses Velikovsky, who's, you know, Einstein died with Velikovsky's book open on his desk. The riddle of the frozen giants now comes up. The mammoths in Siberia. I think we ought to get this book and put it in our intelligence center for those that really want to get into things. I don't want to make it that heavy today. I just want to point out the dopes, the Sunday dopes, do not exclusively represent Christianity. And do you realize we've lost a generation because people have grown up and thought you had to be a Sunday dope to be a Christian? It'll be duped by a dope, a DD degree. Let me keep reading here. These atmospheric currents represent attempts by the atmospheric system to balance the heat budget between the equator and the poles. Such upper atmospheric jet streams undoubtedly characterize the Earth's ancient vapor canopy. This poor mosaic of low, one of the planet Io, Jupiter's moons, was made in the photograph taken by Voyager 1 spacecraft. It's new because it doesn't have so many dents in it, is what all that says. Then here's a photograph of the planet Venus, acquired on January 10, 1979, by the orbiter spacecraft of the Pioneer Venus Mulder Probe. Shows the dark Y feature. This feature reflects atmospheric motions associated with jet streams by which the heat budget is balanced. The photo was taken from an altitude of 29,700 miles. The Mulder Probe, which split into four probes and a bus, entered Venus' atmosphere on December 9, 1978, and sent back extensive data before the searing atmosphere destroyed the probes on the surface. The surface temperature of Venus has been measured at 890 degrees Fahrenheit. Photograph of the planet Venus taken with the orbiter spacecraft, the Pioneer Venus Mulder Probe, on January 14, 1979, from an altitude of 40,000 miles. The cloud canopy on Venus consists possibly of hydrochloric acid, water vapor, and other substances. It floats in an atmosphere that is largely carbon dioxide, more than 80%. The base of the Venus canopy is located about 20 miles from the planet's surface, so you have what would be called a firmament or an expanse of 20 miles between Venus' surface and the bottom of the canopy. Notice the swirls in the clouds. These swirls are likely indicators of global circulation, whereby the heat budget between the equator and the poles is balanced. Because of this atmospheric circulation, the temperatures at the poles of Venus are the same as those at the equator. A similar situation may have existed on the ancient Earth under the vapor or water canopy. Now, when the flood came, you can count rainfall by the inch, and there's no way that in 40 days and 40 nights enough rain could have fallen under any circumstance that we know on Earth today to create the flood. The Bible says the waters above broke loose through the gates, and down they came. I mean, talk about living below a dam. I I mean, if I'd lived in those days, the first thing I'd have done is learn to swim. I'd have slept with a snorkel outfit on. It never rained, ever. No rainbow. They didn't know what rain was. Now, this book just builds further on the theory that many have used, that Isaac Vail, before we had the benefit of these probes, had worked out. And to state it simply, Isaac Vail argued that the earth had a circulating canopy above it. And the sun outside the canopy, this book works out which stars could be seen through that canopy. But basically, there were alternating light and dark sections, but there never was night as we know it. And if you read the opening of the Genesis passage carefully, there's morning and evening of the same day, but not necessarily any nighttime as we know it. This circling canopy would be lighted in such a way that as it turned and the earth turned, there would come the darker portion of it, but still lighted, and then the brighter portion as this cloud vapor, if you take Vail's idea, circled around the earth. And it created a greenhouse effect of relatively constant balanced temperature over the whole earth. Adam and Eve could run around naked and not freeze. The whole earth was about the same. And the only break in the canopy was near the pole. So the stars that could be seen, that's why he plotted the angle of the stars that could be seen under the canopy. You would look to the north, and the canopy would break open to the north. Here's the surface of the earth, but looking to the north, the canopy would tend to break open. And you would see stars and night and bright sky, luminous light during the day. Not the sun per se, nor the moon, but you'd see the moon has no light. It reflects the sun's light. The canopy would reflect the sun's light. And by this theory, you would look to the north. Here's a picture. And the starry isle, as it would be called, would be seen to the north. The canopy would be the white area here now above it. And then the opening would be to the north. And you'd see all the stars, particularly the North Star, to the north. Does this explain why that to the ancients heaven was always to the north? This was the opening through the canopy. Does this explain the so-called mountain of God that every single religion looks to? And was north a bit different than the north that we now know, a true north, not a magnetic north, not necessarily a polar north? And could Atlantis have been there with a mountain that went above and beyond the canopy? And was that the possible theory in the memory traces of man that made Nimrod and his crowd think they could build a tower that would reach to heaven? Because the canopy was low and the mountain of God went past the canopy and heaven was out there beyond the canopy, the sons of God descended. I get interested in these things. And why should a Christian stop thinking? Now, the Bible clearly indicates that people used to be smarter than they are now. We're just now discovering what the ancients knew And then they became evil and God destroyed them and we started over. I've already said this. Is it possible that the reason they lived so long before the flood and began to get shorter and shorter life after the flood is that before the flood they were not exposed to the aging effect of the sun's rays? Now the details, if you want to dig into it, get into this book. This book is, see what the price of it is. I bet you I sell it out of every bookstore in town. It's heavy stuff. Can't find the price. We'll try to get it in our bookstore if we can. But it's Joseph C. Dillow, The Waters Above, Earth's Pre-Flood Vapor Canopy, revised edition by Moody Press. Now, the point I make for this Sunday afternoon is, hey, before you start ditching the Bible and ditching Christianity because of the Sunday dose, that prance around and simplify God until a watermelon seed could contain him, back off and give truth a chance. Truth is just now catching up to God. Evolution says we started out dumb, then getting progressively smarter. The Bible says we started out smart, got suddenly dumb, and then progressively dumber for a while, and then starting to get smart finally. That's in line with the Bible. The Bible describes a pre-flood earth. Nobody else can figure out how we find mammoths up in Siberia. There are lots of other theories. Polar tilts and crust of the earth moving. But the canopy theory is close to the Bible. Now let's go back to old Isaac Bale to show you how long this has been around and nobody's ever done anything with it. Am I boring you? As I now enter upon the examination of the first few chapters of Genesis, I desire to be understood. Well, let's get through his opening stuff. I think the evidence of a canopy phenomenon is sufficiently prevalent in primitive times to arrest the serious attention of the scientific student of antiquity. By some mysterious procedure, Isaac Bale says, the Bible preserves in the most faithful, natural, and philosophic prospect the delineation of a panorama which other ancient scriptures have presented as disjoined and broken intimations. And he sounds like a pedantic scientist as he lays his groundwork. He says, for example, if in Genesis I read that God created great whales, I don't look to the evidence of biblical revelation to convince me that such was a fact. I look to the fact that the sentence would never have been inscribed if some such monsters were not known to exist. It makes no difference whether future translators render the word tannin, whales, titans, dragons, or fishes. And he's pointing out that the Bible doesn't really say that a whale swallowed Jonah. It uses a word that's been variously translated with the generic commonality of a big fish. And there was, apparently, big fishes around. Man saw something they call tannin. The fact that we translate it whale because we haven't had a first-hand encounter with the Loch Ness monster recently. The whale is just the biggest fish we can find. He goes on to say, if I'm told that infant man lived naked in Eden, I don't need the evidence of biblical revelation to teach me that his home was warm. This is what I call inherent testimony. Testimony that's inherent no matter how presented. Now he says, in the remarkable Hebrew legend of creation, after all that introduction, one feature at the very first stands forth conspicuously. Namely, that the advent of light occurred before the sun was presented to the gaze of man. Something veiled that luminary we call the sun, and yet permitted its piercing beams to penetrate the covering. For God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Let 1,000 men read this, Veil says, every man must say it means a vapor-hidden sun, light beaming down through a veil long before the solar disk itself could be seen. But it is also plain that no such veil could thus be drawn between man and the solar orb, our universe being as it is, unless those vapors revolved independently around the earth. Law is law in every part of creation, and no mere vapors could float in the heavens then or now unless they had a motion of their own. They would simply sink to the earth. Revolving vapors, then, are announced by the author of Genesis in the very beginning of the narrative. Now, I'll translate it and say revolving something, not necessarily vapors. But he's promoting his theory. The fact that is non-contradictory is light was seen on the earth before the sun was seen, which puts something between the sun, the source of the light, and the light that is seen. You can see light in a room without seeing the bulb. Now let's go on. This is heavy stuff. With canopy vapors predicated, let us behold the resulting harmony. And again, I always teach to give a gestalt. Whether any one of his points can be argued with, he lays a pretty good total gestalt down. Am I boring you with this heavy stuff? The narrative states further that the spirit or wind of God, or gods, because it's Elohim, moved on the face of the waters and said, "Let there be light." Now, what waters did this spirit move upon? Here again, we must deal with inherent testimony. It would never have been stated that the spirit moved upon the waters unless men knew there were waters. And these located too, where men thought God lived. Makes no difference whether God lived or not. The statement shows that man, to whom this truth was allegedly revealed, if we stay the skeptic, had the opinion of waters over which, on which, or in which God, as spirit or wind, moved and manifested himself. Where did man locate this moving deity? The answer to this question must also answer the former one. What waters did this Spirit of God move upon? That is, if we locate the deity in the view of this primitive man, we locate the waters. Is it too heavy? I don't have the Sunday dope crowd. I forgot for a minute. Now, I presume there's not a man who knows anything at all of the great world's primitive thoughts. Whether ancient Hebrew, Assyrian, Iranian, Egyptian, Indian, Grecian, Roman, Celtic, or American, that doesn't know that the chief deity of all ancient peoples dwelled on high and in the heavens, sometimes on a mountain. Most emphatically, this was the case of the ancient Hebrews, who eventually called their deity the Most High God, the God of the highest heaven. Then it is plain that the waters over which moved the spirit of the Hebrew deity were on high. The whole point he's trying to make is that waters were high and not low, in the context of a separation to come in a moment. As we all know that the light came in from above, though the sun wasn't seen, and that the waters over which his spirit was manifested were also above, we can readily understand the intent or inherent testimony in the legend. The statement is made that darkness was upon the face of the deep. But the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters and said, let there be light. And there was light. From this statement, it is plain that the waters where the Spirit moved and the deep where the darkness was were one and the same. That is, the deep was on high. When all this is done, the only contribution I make is take some of this heavy stuff and simplify it without distorting it. I'll try to do that in a minute. This being the case, it is readily seen that the narrator meant when he wrote, the earth was waste and desolate, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. For it's plain he is describing the earth and the heavens. Now, I've lost you already, but hang on. I mean, he lost us. These two objects he certainly had in mind for the context. These two objects he certainly had in mind for the context shows that the firmament, which is called heaven, or was called heaven, was in the midst of the waters. The sacred penman, then, began his description of heaven and an earth that were familiar to him or revealed to him. Of course, I'm, for the obvious reason, committed to the former. Now, you know where this veil's coming from. He believes the penman was describing the earth that was familiar to him and the heavens. The other alternative is the earth and the heavens that was revealed to him. This writer takes the former, I take the latter. Now, I take the simple view that poor old Moses up there got his mind boggled on Mount Sinai, and an angel told him all the information. But let's go on with Baal. The Hebrew penman, then, let us say, was somehow familiar with the desolated earth and a dark deep above it. We are then compelled to place the waters and the deep, here spoken of in Genesis, in the Hebrew sky or heaven. You don't have to go through the convoluted description that Baal did in typical 18th century style, because this is but a translation, a reprint of that 18th century article by Baal, to understand that God's Spirit on high was hovering over waters. Either the earth was totally covered with waters, or the earth was surrounded by a canopy of waters as a result of the desolation that hit the earth. Now, you'll remember in the story of Atlantis, the Solon says that many times the earth was destroyed by flood. You who know anything about Edgar Cayce, and I don't discount him, has many, many past destructions of the earth. The Solon said when he talked to Plato, we only know, the Greeks haven't even recorded the one they know about, when Atlantis in one terrible day was destroyed. We have the record of one, but we have the hint of Jeremiah seeing the earth when there was no man, and there were, I'm going to leave Baal for a minute and talk in my terms, when there was no man, but there were meeting places of intelligent beings. He's in the past tense. He sees a great cataclysm strike the earth, and then exact wordage as Genesis 1:2, the earth becomes a waste and a desolation as mountains move and the earth is hit with a cataclysm. We know that Satan was in Eden while he was still the crowning cherub of, quote, the mountain of God, before he fell, and it was in Eden that he became lifted up in pride. So I have no trouble at all in believing this earth may have gone through several cataclysms. But at one point, God begins a recreative task, which is why when he creates Adam and Eve, he says, replenish the earth. And let's assume for a moment with Baal that this earth, you have the surface, and then you have a deep of water that is the canopy going around and around and around this earth. That's what he's saying. That's all he's been saying. And the Holy Spirit is hovering there. The waters and the deep, both. are in the Hebrew sky. Now, I take the position it was shown to Moses by an angel. Baal takes the position that the oracle of God in the Hebrew stream spoke of an earth through either some memory traces or some knowledge, or whomever wrote the book of Genesis was drawing upon earlier writers that had laid a record down. And there's support for that, such as the book of Noah or the book of Enoch and other lost books. And therefore, the book of Genesis, in that sense, becomes a compilation. And I'm well aware of higher criticism and the two different basic sets of Genesis in their sections based upon the use of the God Elohim, El God, or the Yahweh. I don't buy it. I believe that God knew what existed, and the angel told Moses, and I hold the old-fashioned view that Moses wrote it, and he penned it. And Moses was taught in all the wisdom of the ancient Egyptians, but God added a knowledge that came from the angels. So that's my view. But I concur with Baal, not yet ready to concur that it was a vapor canopy, but I concur with Baal that the earth was surrounded by waters. Not waters as we now know it, just one bunch of water all around the earth, but a canopy. He says vapor. From vapor to water, while I explore the subject with us, circulating or rotating, and the Hebrew, clearly in Genesis, has the deep and the waters out on high, not down below. How am I going? This commits us then, irretrievably, Baal says, to the canopy idea. I would agree, not necessarily his kind of canopy, but some kind. For it cannot be disputed that waters in the heavens that shut out the solar beam and cause darkness must have revolved around the earth as a great belted canopy system. For waters could not remain there unless they did so revolve any more than a stone. Now, if they were a very thick kind of canopy of water, then the earth would be covered with darkness. Thin them out a little. Just thin them out a little. Am I boring you? But waters could not remain there unless they revolve. Now, it's not a little remarkable that this Hebrew story in Genesis, in so short a space, should thrice announce conditions which can mean nothing if they do not predicate emphatic canopy conditions. To say that darkness was upon the face of the deep is to say that a canopy of vapors dense enough to occult or totally hold out the sun moved on high. He keeps saying vapors. I'm saying waters. Okay? But, you know, I don't quarrel with vapors. I'm just not as sure as they are yet. To say that darkness was there is to say that that belt of revolving canopy totally shut out the sun. As primitive man reduced all visible phenomena and motion to the immediate manifestations of deity, it has seemed very plain to my mind, Baal says, that the spirit or wind which the untutored mind saw moving on the face of the waters was the visible motion of revolving waters. Not necessarily so, but not necessarily wrong either. The God moving to and fro makes this thing move. The inherent testimony is that man saw something moving along the upper waters, and he wouldn't have said so. Well, again, Baal's writing from the frame that the scientific frame would take, that this description of the earth then had an observer, man, looking. My Bible says, not necessarily so. God was telling the condition to a man that wasn't there if he revealed it to Moses. The point I keep making, which is the gestalt of this afternoon, is that throughout the history of the church, there have been men from the scientific frame, from the cultural frame, from the artistic frame, honest searchers after truth. that have come to grips with the fact they're going to find truth in God's Word, and they've wrestled with it with all their might, trying, like a snake getting rid of its skin, to make a scientific explanation of supernatural happenings. The point is, they weren't dopes. If they had a weakness, some of them were so captured by their academic training, they weren't willing to do what I'm willing to do. Once I settle the resurrection, I don't have any trouble with God coming down on a hill and telling Moses, hey, this is the way it was when no man was there. I don't have any trouble with God coming down through an angel and telling Jeremiah in a past tense vision, hey, this is the way it was when there were meeting places of intelligent beings on earth when there was no man on earth. This is the way it was when the pre-Adam denizens and followers of the leadership on earth, which was vested in Satan before he fell, who was in Eden before he fell, who was in Eden when he became lifted up in pride and started the rebellion against heaven. This is the way it was. And a cataclysm struck the earth, and mountains moved, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. And then he tells back to Moses again, Spirit of the Lord hovered over the face of the deep. But inside all these differences, a struggling Isaac Bale who comes as a scientist and doesn't want to have to accept anything miraculous in it at all. As far as I'm concerned, God could have spit and water started circulating. I have no trouble with miracle because my Christian faith starts with it. But by the same token, I want it understood, you don't have to cut your head off to be a Christian. Sometimes it gets in the way, but you don't have to cut it off to be a Christian. And if you'll keep pushing, you know, I'd like to have been locked in a room for 2 days with Bale, where I, from my philosophic frame, could have shaken his scientific foundations a bit with what has happened in the last 75 years, to where he could start all over with the canopy theory without having a man down there looking at it. But the man was a genius. Let's keep going. I like this, whether you do or not. If you don't like it, turn the knob. I'm going to stay with it for a while. The inherent testimony is that man saw something moving. When we have concluded that the deep and the waters and the darkness and the light were located on high as canopy features, we can all see very plainly the picture is not perfect unless there was a visible motion of the same features. If the penman said the Spirit of God hung motionless, the declaration would have been a manifest contradiction, for there could not have been a deep on high without visible motion. Well, that's from the scientist view. But God, like the Lord of the Sabbath, could do what he wants. But I have no trouble with Bale's conclusion that God, once setting these laws in motion, unless there's a reason, will probably move within those laws. When God organizes something, why throw sand in the wheels just to prove he's God? He's not that insecure. So from the scientist standpoint, most of the time God will do something without upsetting the laws of nature because he doesn't have the need to show off like the Sunday dopes do. You don't have to stay away from hospitals and doctors to prove your faith. Just be selective. Staying away from hospitals and doctors sometimes is an act of intelligence, not faith, if you haven't found the right hospital and the right doctor. Don't mix the two. It's like, don't make a religious argument when it's not a religious issue. Faith is faith, whether you exercise it just before you go under the anesthetic, or whether you stay home. Faith says God can do what man can't do. But God really is not against hygiene and proper medical action. They used to say when babies died of polio, God's will. Then Salk discovers a vaccine, and God changed his mind. That's the Sunday dope religion. And that's not the true religion. Now, I believe that if the creation record is correct, a better assumption than Bale's assumption is that if a man were allowed by God to be transported, whether in the body or out of the body, to be an onlooker and view the creative scene, that man would be able to describe what happened in the way that Isaac Vale is assuming somebody must have described it. I could say it that way much better. I believe God, if he's going to... I don't believe Moses, for example, if God brought an angel and told him how it happened, sat there like a Sunday dope and just wrote meaningless phrases. There's every possibility, whether in the body or out of the body, that like he did with John on the Isle of Patmos, he let Moses be an onlooker in what would be interpreted as a visionary portrayal. I mean, don't you think God could set up a screen and show the whole thing? I'm being ludicrous, of course. But, you know, if you believe in God, he can show Moses everything while Moses is hidden behind that cloud on Mount Sinai, if that's where the revelation came. So I don't have difficulty with Baal postulating the viewpoint of a man who is seeing it as the 7 days of creation unfold, or any being seeing it. I just have difficulty with him assuming that the creation story comes out of a man's memory package rather than a revelation by God to someone that God makes it clear to how it was. Now let's continue. The next verse announces another canopy fact. Let us remember the darkness spoken of in the second verse was on the face of the deep, and that the deep was in the Hebrew heaven, not down in a hole. But there was also was the light which was called good. How then are we to reconcile the apparent inconsistency of both light and darkness on the face of the same upper deep? Is it not a little remarkable that in all ancient world thought light is a good spirit and darkness a bad one? In other writings, I've tried to show how this good thought originated in the light of heaven, which mankind beheld as eternally opposed to darkness. As the darkening vapors vanished, light triumphed and the good prevailed. Let's turn our telescope to Saturn or Jupiter. On either planet, we behold dark bands divided or separated by intensely white sunlit bands. One of Jupiter's dark belts is large enough to overcanopy the whole Earth, and it is divided almost centrally by a white or sunlit streamer. And he goes on to explain that the canopy itself has the dark bands called darkness and the light bands called light, and the canopy, or the division of the light, is in these upper waters where there's a light section and a dark section. Let us remember that so far, the narrative gives us no intimation of any kind of darkness save what was on the face of the deep. And that's true. The Genesis record says darkness was on the face of the deep. And God divided darkness and light. Baal's theory is the canopy had light sections and dark sections. Anybody been around to argue with him? Am I boring you? If we desire more positive testimony as to the location of the waters, we have but to read the sixth verse. You ought to have it open by now, of Genesis. We have but to read the sixth verse of the first chapter of Genesis, which says, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters." In connection with the eighth verse, which expressly states that God called the firmament heaven. Now, if we had any doubt that this deep or these waters that we've been talking about, on which or in which the Spirit of God moved, which was divided into light and dark on the face of it, if we have any doubt that this deep and these waters were on high, it certainly is dispelled when God divides them and says, put a firmament in the middle of them and call this heaven. Because heaven now is under the top part. You know what he just said? All I really want to do is just boggle your mind today. All I really want to accomplish, which is the gestalt that I'm talking about, a feel. Forget every detail. I want only one thought to arrive today when I'm done. It doesn't matter whether you remember one-tenth of what I say, or you're one of those super bright ones that knew what I was going to say before, said it, figured it out, analyzed Baal, analyzed me, and came up with your own conclusion. It doesn't matter whether you listen as the genius or the struggling one. One thought can come home to everybody. Our traditional simple-minded views may not be capable of simple-minded support by Genesis itself. The point I make is scientists have been laughing at the Genesis record, but the record they laugh at is not what Genesis says. So, do I need to say that again? It's the age-old straw man tactic. You are ignorant of somebody you don't like. Really ignorant of them. So you oversimplify briefly their position, which is not their position at all. It's not an accurate description of the person you're going to tear into. You have created a non-existent straw man caricature and passed it off as the true position of the one you're going to attack or destroy. And then having created this non-existent straw man, you proceed to tear the straw stack down. That's the way scientists have treated the scripture. And because Sunday dopes have accepted a dopey view, they perpetuate the error. I've been laying foundations for months for both the book of Revelation and the book of Genesis before I even start going through it verse by verse. Because I don't want to deal with somebody, King James, good enough for Paul, good enough for me. And God created Adam. And man became a living soul. That isn't what it says. Excuse me, it doesn't say that at all. What it says is God created Adam and breathed into him. And Adam became a living soul. It doesn't say a dang word about man generically. In fact, it took subsequent years for somebody to decide that Adam was the prototype man. And that all man resides in Adam. All the Bible says is God created Adam. And Adam became a living soul. Now, what does Adam mean? And when you analyze the meaning of the word Adam, both its numerical meaning as well as its etymological meaning, you may start to understand what was created that day. And yet generations have gone to school and had their faith destroyed by some nonentity that couldn't read three words of Hebrew, standing up in a science classroom and saying the Bible is not scientific, belittling it. You know, it's very interesting in this country. It's okay to belittle the Bible in the classroom, you just can't teach it. As long as you're putting it down, you can make all the references you want. As long as you're destroying faith, that's perfectly acceptable. But if you even read it in a positive frame, or treat it as literature in a positive frame, you're in trouble. The gestalt I want to come home today is Christianity's not as dumb as either the dopes have made it or its enemies have made it. It needs a chance to be looked at by somebody that keeps their brains in their cranium. God's been misrepresented. The great fraud of the centuries. The misrepresentation of God by both his so-called dopey friends and his enemies. About time somebody get a true picture. It's gone. At least if there's a firmament in the midst of the waters and the firmament divides the waters and it's called heaven, then, my Lord, now heaven is below the waters in this case. That's what it said, right or wrong. Well, I see, you know, I got a Bible, I know how to read. See if this old boy's tricking us. Been done before, you know. Skeptic like me better check it. God said, sixth verse, let there be a firmament. Now, let me tell you what that word means, and this is one of the times the King James translators, if they put it in the margin, are very right. The word being translated firmament means expanse. Is that in your margin? God said, let there be an expanse, an expansion, a space in the midst of the waters, and let it, that is, that expanse, divide the waters from the waters. Now, constantly, those who have read it from the Sunday dope frame have taken a vertical happening and turned it sideways and made it horizontal. Oh, Pacific Ocean separated from the Atlantic Ocean. That isn't what's said, because I'm going to tell you the land between ain't heaven. You know, they've read it through 62, 72, and 82. Missed the whole point. God made the firmament, divided the waters which were under the firmament, not opposite, from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so, and God called the firmament heaven. Is that what it says or not? He put an expanse between the waters. Before the waters were expanded, they were so tight they shut all light out. Everything was dark. So he thins it out a bit. Separates it into two layers. Water above and water below, firmament between, expanse between, he calls it heaven. Now we need to analyze that word heaven. But that's not the subject right now. Veil doesn't doing that, and I'm on veil today. The conclusion is evident and indisputable. No deep, but a canopy deep. No waters, but canopy waters. Divided by firmament. It's going to be called heaven. Now, the Hebrew word is rakia. Called firmament. Later called heaven. And it's between waters. Some under, and some above. And God made the rakia. I'm going to put the right word in. And divided the waters which were under the rakia from the waters which were above the rakia. And it was so. And again, unless all natural law is suspended, the waters above the rakia rotated. Canopy. Let's make a digression. If the darkness so alluded to in these first verses of Genesis was on this lofty abyss, let us remember the position of the dark waters was above. And this is the testimony of all myths, and my view of myths is that in the memory traces of mankind everywhere are passed on the knowledge of the world that then was. God chose an oracle people in Abram, clarified the accurate record to Moses, a descendant of Abram, and in the Hebrew tradition of the Bible we have the accurate presentation of the legends. Now, there was a craze not too long ago that when they uncovered the Gilgamesh epic and then others, that all the Hebrew stories in Genesis contained were but a variant of one among many mythological legends of creation and subsequent events. My view, I think the Christian view, is that God chose an oracle to put a plumb line down and tell the accurate record. The rest of the myths represent human attempts to perpetuate a record without God's help. That's why you'll find the other mythological representations adding addendums and twists and turns. But the accurate oracle, it's like a scribe being supervised versus scribes not being supervised. Why have I got that up? Am I going out of something? Did I leave somebody? I left Communicom Cable. Who said? Well, I guess it's Valley Cable we're on all day. Yeah, just Communicom. We go out at 4:30. See you later, Communicom. See you tonight. We come on every night. Rest of you, turn Communicom Cable. Turn 99.5 FM on. Then you'll enjoy the pictures on radio. Can we go on? I mean, Communicom Cable will be with us all night, and they can see this on a rerun somewhere. Or they can turn to the radio. I believe that the oracle people were chosen precisely to be God's supervised penmen, to tell the record of truth under supervision. The rest of the stories were stories without a supervisor. But they will come from the same root. The branches will begin to deviate as time goes on. But as you trace their root, the generic gestalt, the commonality will tell you, an extra proof that residing in the mankind at large is this memory trace of these happenings. And all the Vedic Varuna, the Egyptian Amun, the Greek Uranus, Scandinavian gods, all of them have them brooding on the face of the waters in ephemeral heavens. Now the Hebrew tells us a part of those vanishing skies fell and were gathered into seas. Now let's keep reading in Genesis. God said, let the waters under the heaven. Let's read the 8th verse. God called the firmament, that's expanse, Rakia. Right in the margin, everywhere you see a firmament, write the word Rakia. Well, you know, there is no common spelling. It can be A-R-A-K-I-A or R-A-Q-U-I-A. There is no such thing as a common spelling because they didn't even have vowels. But Rakia is the word, as close as we can come. And God called, just spell it R-A-K-I-A, that's probably the easiest. God called the Rakia heaven. And the evening and the morning were the second day. Where do you get that out of that day and night? There was no day and night, as we know day and night. Because the light on that firmament kept it glowing and reflecting night and day. There was only a shadier and a brighter. And it was daylight all the time because of the reflections ricocheting through the firmament. And this is worked out in much detail in the formulas in the waters above. Now, under such a condition, there is probably reason to believe that the world pre-Adam, the world in which Lucifer and intelligent beings, Ayar is the word that Jeremiah calls cities. Jeremiah says there was no man on this earth he saw, but there were cities. The word literally means meeting place for intelligent beings. Doesn't necessarily mean cities. Intelligent beings would be Lucifer before he fell, and those under his domain before he took a third of heaven and rebelled against God. He was in Eden before he fell. Isaiah makes that clear. That's where he became lifted up in pride. Now, most probably, if the canopy theory works at all, and the pre-flood earth was a canopied earth, most probably the pre-Genesis 1-2 recreated earth, the pre-Adam earth, the one in which Satan ruled before he became Satan, while he was still the crowning cherub in the mountain of God. Most probably, he lived and ruled in an Eden on an earth that was canopied. And under such conditions over the centuries, it's very probable that dinosaur-type creatures could have developed and moved about. And Satan and his cohorts could handle them. I doubt Alley-Oop could straddle one, like the comedies say. I have an interesting little deal here. By the way, Vail was the first one to discover why the canopy and its reflections could have produced the almost universal worship of the great dragon spirit in primitive societies. And likewise, some of these ancient flying creatures would have required a kind of wind current velocity to stay aloft that only the canopy type earth structure would create. Again, I'm not selling any of these ideas. I'm just simply saying, you know, God has had a few friends that aren't dopes. I got one simple message today. This is Sunday Dope Day. And I'm trying to say, hey, you don't have to be a dope every Sunday to be a Christian. I'm getting myself ready for what I watch tonight on TV. I think this is interesting. The God of all primitive races, in their memory traces, originally hovered atop the waters. I preached about 4 years ago. I said, give me some fun to speculate. Because the study of hieroglyphics, the most ancient written signs, and particularly the ancient religious hieroglyphics, are picture representations of the truth first. They always have God on high sitting on a mountain. The God of the mountain. But there's something else. The God that they worship that subsequently becomes the sun god is not the sun as we know it, but rather Saturn with his rings. Now, well, that's another subject. I'm running out of time. Now let's go to something else. The appearing isle now comes into use. For the writer of Genesis expressly states the fact that the Creator placed the stars in the firmament and speaks of the lights of the heaven or light bearers or lucifers of the sky, but never once says a word about sun or moon. The word here translated light is maor, is never rendered sun nor moon. Yet there can be no question that the writer would have used the Hebrew words for sun and moon if he meant those bodies. We have here the strongest possible circumstantial evidence that this book was written when the sun and moon were unknown to man as they are today. This conclusion is rendered particularly strong by the singular fact that the writer of Genesis does mention the stars. We're irresistibly led to conclude he mentioned stars because he did see them. And he never mentioned moon or sun because he didn't see it. The sun, the mighty king of the physical heavens, was without a name in this earliest record of creation when all else familiar to man, waters and seas and heavens and stars, were all called by their names. Men name things when they see them. And the sun unnamed means the sun was unseen and unknown. Now, that logic sort of breaks down. Because man has named God and didn't see him. A better point to be made is that God was giving to Moses the record of the way creation would look to a man if he were on the earth. And the man on the earth with the canopy there would not see the sun and the moon. He would see the glow of the light. The glow of the light that totally was lit up in light and dark bands, or light or darker bands, and which rotated around the earth but had an opening at the poles. You could see out like a, and you know, all the ancient cosmogonies had the earth sitting in an ancient sea with the island of the earth in the middle of all the waters and a dome over it, reflecting back to the days of a view of a canopy. But in the revolving canopy of the earth, you could look out to the north, and over the horizon you would see, or you'd look out to what would be true north, the break in the canopy based upon the revolving, and you would see stars at that level. That's why in this book he breaks down the points on the horizon that they could be seen under the canopy. Now, if heaven is the expanse, get ready, I'm going to put it in my terms now, between the waters above, the rotating canopy, and the earth below, which horizontally will be separated into land and water. And if heaven is the space or expanse, and the expanse goes out through the north to the regions beyond, then the touch of heaven is here to all heaven outward. Do I need to do that again, or you follow me? The expanse is heaven. And heaven reaches through the north, where they can see the stars, to the vast space of the stars beyond. Which makes sense to build a tower to heaven in Nimrod's day. I'm boring you. I think I am. Everybody that I have not put to sleep and is interested in this kind of stuff, you want me to get a few copies of this book in our store? Joseph C. Dillow, The Waters Above. What I've been reading from is an ancient book by Isaac Vail, reprinted. If you are not a Sunday dope, and you're still alive, and you believe that television deserves a few voices on it that can say you can be a thinking man and still be a Christian, you can be a real man and still be a Christian, that supernatural in its pure meaning means more natural, and that God came down and camped with us and brought His grace to lead us back, and Jesus said, I am the truth. If you're glad you don't have to be a dope to be a Christian, and that in fact, when we get that silliness out of our head, about the only way you can assemble all the disjointed knowledge of this world, which is like strings of, it's like pearls off a string, God's Word, rightly divided and rightly interpreted, becomes the thread which enables you to string all the pearls of truth into a coherent necklace of whole truth. And if you're glad that that's the case, and at the same time you want to take a poke at the devil that thought he had silenced us a year ago, this is a university network, and we're staying up there still communicating the truth that is in God. Because all I wanted you to get today is, where has the church been in not telling us? I haven't come up with the things I've been teaching these several years. I haven't come up with it out of whole cloth. If anything, God gifted me with a gestalting ability to grab it here and grab it there and weave it together with God's Word. But all this stuff's been around. We just had the church pulpits dominated by lazy-minded dopes for too long. And it's time for the strong and the intelligent to stand up and say, I've had it, and I'm not going to put up with it any longer. Let us not forget, I'm going to frustrate the people that are on the phone now. Let us not forget that the canopy becomes the all-powerful earth regulator in the sun's absence. This is because somebody just said, if it did not rain, where'd the people get their water? Let us not forget that the canopy becomes the all-powerful earth regulator in the sun's absence. It is the earth lighter and earth heater. For the sun not only pours its light, but its heat into the ocean of the canopy. The day canopy becomes a world heater, and the night canopy becomes a world cooler. The atmosphere in immediate contact with the canopy during the heated day would become laden with the moisture, for warm air demands more moisture than cold air. But the moment the hidden sun went down into the underworld and shadow crept the lighter canopy into the upper skies, the temperature would fall enough that moisture absorbed by the air during the warmer hours fell as a heavy mist upon the ground, which is exactly what the Bible says. It was warmed, the earth was watered with a dew during the night, and during the evening, and no rain ever fell. Once again, science has to presume that all things, science has its faith that becomes a religion. Its faith is that all things have always happened at the same rate that things now happen. Uniformitarianism, the great doctrine of uniformitarianism. If it took so many years to make a tree ring, it always took so many years to make a tree ring. If it took so many years for a mountain to become a sedimentary plain, it always took so many years for a mountain to become a sedimentary plain. Everything continued the same way at the same rate always. Therefore, the biblical account of the pre-flood earth with no rain, no rainbow, just simply could not be. Well, if there was a canopy, the scientists are wrong and the Bible's right, and science can be made to reconcile with the canopy. Where'd the canopy go? God just blew it up and opened the gates, and you all stopped talking. So play again. That was my way to test whether or not you like to listen on Sunday. Isn't it nice to know that you're going to be talking to non-Sunday dopes?